I am Roy Malloy, and you are listening to The Dawn of Crime, a podcast that I've dedicated to the history of Australia's criminality, the faces and the places and the people who made us arguably the land of dreams when it comes to the shifty grey area of the law where criminals tend to thrive. But I've got a fascinating person I'm going to be interviewing today, and I've been really looking forward to this. This is, I get a lot of people who say, can I interview them? And they specialize in a bushranger or a criminal, like, you know, somebody that comes and goes, and they do a pretty standard job of being a crook. Nothing more interesting have I ever seen than what we're about to talk to today. The lady we're going to be talking to is an academic historian and somebody who's really delved deep into some of the more peculiar and fascinating parts of not only Australian history, but international histories. But I'm going to be talking today with Dr. Jo Klein. Welcome to the show, Dr. Jo.
Thank you so much, Roy. I'd like to do a little correction. I'm actually a pro-academic, so I work very casually in universities, but generally I'm a consultant. So I don't know if I'd title myself an academic, but I like to think of myself as a pro-academic, someone who really applies what they do to a few different sort of areas, I suppose, outside the university, in different areas. So the person I'm going to be talking about today, it's a personal interest of mine, is in the history of magic, because one of my little sidelines is that I am a magician and have been doing that for a little while. So anything that intersects between history and magic really interests me. And the person I've chosen is called Madame Gurkha. Now, her real name was not Madame Gurkha, as with many people who are fortune tellers. Her real name was Julia Gibson, which doesn't sound quite as fancy. And she was someone who operated in Melbourne in the 1920s, a little bit earlier, and sort of onwards in the 30s, 40s, 50s. So as I've said, if you're a fortune teller, you have to have a very exotic name. Now, Julia Gibson actually was fairly exotic because she was born in Russia. And she did come to Australia when she married a vaudeville performer called Henry Gibson. He was Australian, and they did a tour and arrived in Australia eventually. So, yes, Roy.
Can you describe what a vaudeville performer does? Because that was lost on a lot of people.
Obviously, it's something very close to your heart. A vaudeville performer, it's one of the best types of performance because it's something for everyone. Vaudeville performance is lots of short acts. And it's a type of variety show. They're not as popular anymore, but you would have a singer or again a comedian and a magician and maybe a quick change artist and a lot of people doing short things. So a big show with a big cast of people. It's almost like a comedy night. We have lots of different spots of comedians, but it was people doing all sorts of things like tap dancing or singing or playing an instrument.
And what was her husband's act?
And how? Well, he was a vaudevillian. He actually performed as a magician, but he also did circus. So I think he was one of those multi-skilled performers who did a lot of different things. But that's where she got the Gibson part of her name. And I'm assuming that Julia would have been, you know, Guliar or something, you know, a more Russian version of that. So she needs a title, a fortune-telling title, and she chooses Madame Gurkha. Often the name is preempted with Madam. We know that to be a sort of fortune-telling title. And then Gurkha sort of was to do with people's fascination with the mystic, exotic East. So usually it's associated with Nepal. So she has this name. And she sets up in Melbourne just towards the end of World War I. And this is a very poignant time for fortune telling because of the huge loss of human life during World War I. There are so many men who are missing. There is no news from them. So many men have died. So husbands, fathers, sweethearts, business associates, and everyone is desperate for news because this is the Great War. Things like the Red Cross had only just started in terms of bureaus for missing and wounded. So a lot of people were hungry for information. And also they knew that their loved ones had died in horrible circumstances and they missed them and they weren't able to say goodbye. All of this leads to a hunger for spiritualism. Fortune tellers really did operate very successfully in this time period. Also, there was the same time in the 20s, there's an interest in Egyptomania. So as you know about the Art Deco movement, a lot of it's very Egyptian-based, which is also a very spiritual society. It's about the afterlife. It's about, it's about mummies and spirits and what happens when you die. So all of this set up the scene for fortune tellers beginning to make a trade. The other really interesting aspect that sets the scene for Madame Gurkha is the idea of woman's work. Now, there's a historian called Alana Piper who has written a lot of really interesting things about fortune telling in Australia and Melbourne. But the other thing is when we talk about women's work, we often think about lace making or sewing from home. And the reality was that after World War One, the provider of the family had generally gone. And the support systems weren't in place yet for women who'd lost their income for their family. So they needed to find ways to make money. Some made silk flowers, some were trained in millinery, and some became fortune tellers. So there's a clients who are hungry for news, and there are women who want to work from home, set their own hours and make money and don't necessarily have the education.
Now, prior to coming to Melbourne, what do we know about her and her prior to Melbourne story?
What we do know about her is that she was, I'd say she was a fabulist, someone who doesn't necessarily tell the truth. So throughout her career as a fortune teller, she did appear in court quite a lot of times for various reasons. And sort of her family backstory came into play. She was accused of telling tall stories. She said that she had been a bomb-throwing revolutionary. She spied for the British as a circus performer. And generally, I think the truth of her word was perhaps questioned on more than one occasion. She also had a previous husband prior to marrying Henry Gibson, who she said tried to attack her, and she stabbed him and he went to jail and eventually died. So Henry was her second husband. So people who'd associated with her generally didn't come to a fantastic end. So then
children, she marries this guy. Yeah. What becomes of her career? Is she then just thrown into that motherhood syndrome that is typical of that day, and then that's the last we hear of her? What happens to her after she marries?
Well, she did have children. I think she had four boys. And the other thing is, obviously, you want to provide for them. And later on, there's a court case relating to her husband where she just wants him to go away, basically. The suggestion is that there's been domestic violence and she's taken him to court for domestic violence. She's saying, I have the money to support my boys. I just want him gone. The other thing that sort of comes up in different interpretations of women's work and fortune telling is that it was also a way for women to be financially secure and get away from situations of domestic violence. But
where is she doing this fortune telling? Can you give me a picture of how and where?
She's in Melbourne. She starts off in the Eastern Arcade, where she had sort of a little shop. She didn't start off as a fortune teller, though. She actually made costumes. Now, the thing about this is fortune telling is technically illegal. So you don't really advertise yourself as a fortune teller. And the history of that is that we adopted a lot of our laws from Britain. Obviously, Britain is the mother country. We've only become a federated country in 1901. In these times, you still weren't Australian citizens. So you're still British citizens.
What would the fine be if you were caught doing that? What's the charge?
So that's the thing. It depends how you were sort of prosecuted. So she set up a shop where she obviously said she was a costume maker. A lot of people hid their profession under other guises, but everyone sort of knew what you did. She was brought to court several times because what happened was in trying to flush out fortune tellers. There's kind of a movement at the time where everyone was very interested in scientific theory. You know, we like to be scientific about things, which is the opposite of fortune telling. So there wasn't really aligning with those values. Also trying to be a law-abiding country. They would send in undercover police women or women who'd been trained by the police to find these covert fortune tellers. And generally, I suppose you go to a fortune teller for several reasons, to find out about somebody who's died, perhaps like as a spiritualist or a medium, to find out about your future and to find out about your love life. So women were at a crossroads here. There were less men after World War One. So many of them worried about finding a partner or like a love in their life. They also obviously worried about the lost family members who'd gone during World War One. And then a lot of them were pushed into providing for themselves. They try to think about education and careers and what to do with themselves. So in these police stings, they would come in, and she was very paranoid about it. So she'd often get them to try and sign something to say they weren't police. And there's a bit of a hilarious situation where a woman came in and said, you know, her father had died and she didn't know what to do with herself. And Madame Gurkha had made recommendations about careers and said she was better off with her father being dead because he wouldn't bother her like her mother had been bothered. And then the police officer sort of did the reveal. He's not dead. I'm a police officer and you're next, basically. And she said, I thought you were a police officer because you smelt. So, that's what it says in the newspaper. So that's what we have to take it. Obviously, we know newspapers embellish things for entertainment value, but as reported, that's what happened. Yeah.
Did she face fines or was she ever jailed for this?
She wasn't jailed. She did. She was fined. But the thing is, she was also extremely litigious. So she sued a lot of people. She sued several publications because they had said that she was, first of all, named her as a fortune teller. And then one of them, there was an article about the house that she'd operate out of, which was on 25 to 27 Rathdown Street, Carlton. And it was like, it was a boarding house and she worked out of that. And it was sold in auction in 1949. And she actually sued the newspaper because they said that she was infamous or something like that. She also sued several times for libel as well, because she ended up being a witness in several court cases.
Of the newspapers at the time, for those of you playing along at home, I get a lot of my listeners will tell me that they didn't know particular details. And here's one of them, is that we used to have a newspaper called The Truth. And The Truth used to specialize in almost everything except, ironically, The Truth. they would have loved a celebrity in town like her, wouldn't they?
Well, the thing is, they look for local characters, and that's how we find out sort of more personal details about people from different eras. So actually people, infamous characters or larger-than-life people, you know, it's like the Woman's Weekly, basically, do turn up in Truth. But the other thing is, I think she courted attention. She ended up being an important witness in a gun alley murder case, which is a famous case, from this time period. And basically there was someone who called Colin Ross, who she didn't like. He was accused of murdering a 12-year-old girl. And she acted as a witness, which sort of put him at the scene and suggested that he did it. He was actually given a posthumous pardon in 2008 with evidence supplied that he didn't actually do it, but he was hanged at the time. So I think she liked being in court. She liked being a larger-than-life figure, and she did pop up in a lot of court records.
In amongst the gun alley murders, the fellow who really drove that home was a policeman who we now consider really the father of forensics. Ironically, even though this was a complete botch of a case, the Gun Alley murder, a fellow called Fred Piggott. And Fred Piggott, he also was the scourge of Squizzy Taylor. He was the guy who hunted Squizzy to the ends, you know. But the tragedy of the Gun Alley murder was that she really had a bee in her bonnet about him having a wine saloon near her premise. But it was more of a personal grudge than anything.
She'd heard that there was a prostitution ring sort of happening, so I think she felt that it lowered the tone. But yes, it seems that it was sort of a personal matter that a vengeful sort of, you know, a personal grudge, you're right. Yeah, but I think she did like the attention. I mean, it possibly is that she thought it was good for business. It made her more of a public figure.
So in 1929, she's fined on two charges of having, this is a quote, by subtle craft, included palmistry imposed upon a divorcee. So imposing palmistry is a crime. So then that would also lean to phrenology. And yeah. What else would she be practicing that was illegal? I mean, crystal balls.
Yeah, she did a few things. So one of them was phrenology, which if you haven't heard of phrenology, basically it was a pseudoscience craft. It's reading the bumps of someone's head. So you have a bust, like as a porcelain bust. It's an L.N. Fowler bust is the original one. So you might see it. And then it has on the top of the head, it's sort of divided into sections, and each part of your head represents a characteristic. And by looking at the articulations on your head, you can apparently determine your character. So character readings were really a type of, I suppose, fortune telling, because it suggested that you could sort of predict someone's actions or how they might behave in a certain situation, depending on how the shape of their skull. Interestingly enough, they did write to a phrenologist about Ned Kelly using information about his death mask. The letter of the phrenologist is in the public records office. That's pretty interesting. There actually isn't a report. There's just the evidence that at some point there was communication.
So in that same year that she was accused and charged by the police of, you know, palmistry, that same year they kind of became a bit more aware of her, and they refused her right to renew her license for a revolver. Why do you think she was carrying a revolver?
Well, look, the thing is that I suppose fortune telling is often associated with criminality. It's often part of the illegal nature of it is often associated with vagrancy. If you think about the stereotypical idea of a fortune teller, they're basically dressed as a gypsy, and vagrancy laws were usually applied to gypsies in Europe. So there's that kind of sort of hang on from that. And obviously, my personal opinion is that fortune telling isn't real. It's something you can do for entertainment. So I suppose it's a type of obtaining money for deceptive purposes. That's my perspective on the matter. There are ways that you can spin things for luck. I mean, you can do it with a deck of cards. It's not like you're, each card has an ascribed meaning, so it's just you dealing them, and whatever the cards mean, that's your fortune. But she did do palmistry, looking at someone's hand. She did look at their heads, and sometimes it was just what we call in magic sort of a cold reading. So you would find out, observe things about the person, or find out during subtle questioning information that you can use to provide a realistic assessment of what may happen in the future.
In this time and place in the world, she's not at all alone in this profession, this style of entertainment. Geographically close to where she is at this point in time, moving up Bourke Street, you've got what was then called Paddy's Market, or the West, was it the Eastern Market?
Paddy's Market's in Sydney.
We had a market on the corner of, is it Exhibition and Bourke, where the Southern Hotel was built.
Yeah.
I believe they also called it, as a euphemism, Paddy's Market. the Western market or the Eastern market? I think it's
the Eastern market, yeah.
By that stage, in the as it headed towards its decline in the 1950s, it was rife with what they said was tattoo parlors, fortune tellers. There were several killings also in the spate around about that time. Carrying a revolver for a woman who's leaving work or coming from work in Bourke Street where the rats were common, and by rats, I mean push gangs, that's probably not a silly move. It's probably more protective than anything else.
Possibly. The other thing is that fortune tellers made money. So people knew what her profession was. It could be that someone might try and rob her because she was in a position where she was, I suppose, an independent businesswoman. So she would be worthy of robbing.
Yes.
And of course, she's a prominent and flamboyant character. She's probably also easily recognised. So
then in amongst all of that, it is her ability to create attention and then pick which attention she likes and sue the people who make the attention she doesn't like. Her first case when she was able to sue for defamation, she won £100. Now, Cleo, you're lucky if you had a job that paid £2 a week. So she paid a year's wage, let's say it's $50,000. The second and really the biggest case she wins, she won £1,000 defamation case.
She does pop up every few decades as well. I mean, she was only fined £10 in this brush with the police lady, in this example of an undercover operation. So, you know, if you get fined £10, but you can sue for £100, you know, you've done well.
It speaks of her intellect and her no, it's not just wiliness. To know the legal system is a real gift. In her latter days, did she stay just put, or did she, what you said she became, she kind of popped up every now and then. What were her
life? In 1953, when she was 82, she's actually buried in Faulkner Cemetery. So her death was reported on because she was such a, I think, larger than life and eccentric, figure. Yeah, I think she remained quite memorable to people as well. And also, as you were saying, the 1920s were very sort of big for criminals. So I suppose if you're operating at that time, you would take precautions. So I suppose that's her life. She starts off in Russia. She ends up dying in Melbourne in the 1950s. She sees two world wars. She moves continents, she dabbles in different professions. She seems to know how to take care of herself and, I suppose, manipulate the law to her own effect. And, of course, she was not the only fortune teller. But it was something that did really pop up as a profession for women. It was just in the enforcement of this time period, the sort of moral movement towards clamping down. But I think she provides a nice little insight into a very specific time period and what women sort of did to bend it to their advantage.
Dr. Jo Klein, I want to thank you for coming into this humble little podcast. And for sharing with us your incredible set of stories. You've been listening to Dr. Jo Klein, who is a practical academic, a practicatic.
Academic.
And I'd love you guys to check out The Dawn of Crime by Googling Dawn of Crime on your Googling. And also make sure you hit follow on this podcast wherever you're listening to it from. Thanks again and stay tuned.